T0i is 0. So, or because I only get a contribution at first order to T0i in the stress energy tensor to require that T0i is 0, and to require that E is 0. So I believe this is the correct definition of delta T0i. So there's both the rho bar, B, and actually that is the wrong definition. I screwed up again. I think this is actually 1 plus WVI, and then there's another piece. I'm making a mistake while atoning for my mistakes. This is quite embarrassing. Okay, I forgot that part of the notes, but anyway, there's both a velocity and a rho bar and a B somewhere in there. And I forget exactly where they went, but you'll find it in the notes. Okay, mistake. Okay, anyway, I do believe that this is right. I worked through this the other night. So if I figure out how delta T0i transforms under a gauge transformation, it goes as follows. So you can see that it has both a the zeroth component. Remember, we defined this gauge parameter, and that was made up of C0 and then spatial derivatives of a scalar function, which we called Xi. So to fix delta T0i, I need to specify both Xi0 and the time derivative of Xi. And to fix E, I need to basically just fix Xi. So there was a question that arose with regards to this funny definition, which is, well, according to that definition, is the comoving gauge really unique? It seems like there's this arbitrary time-dependent function that's left unspecified. And that indeed is true for this gauge. For this choice, however, I get rid of that annoying time-dependent function. So here, if I want to fix, just a second, let me finish and then you can ask again. So if I fix E twiddle to be 0, so if I start in some arbitrary gauge and I want to set E to 0, then that involves a choice for Xi, the scalar function, right? Now, once I've made that choice and I want to set delta T0i twiddle to 0, starting from an arbitrary gauge, then I need to fix Xi0. And I guess now perhaps there is some spatial, unspecified spatial function. Yeah, that's true. Okay. So I guess there still is a little bit of arbitrariness in there. Twiddle completely fixed this cage. Maybe I'll take that back. Okay. So it's twiddle because I think actually secretly it kind of does. So anyway, we write the metric like this in this gauge that we will use for all times in the future. So you can see that B appears. And then now the thing that I should have realized, so I was being silly, again, why do we call this the comoving curvature perturbation? Because it completely specifies the three curvature on a slice. Okay, so with this definition, indeed, that is true. You can see the only thing multiplying the spatial metric is this guy Xi, whereas in the funny gauge that I defined before, it actually wasn't true. So first of all, I made a sign error. That was silly of me. And then that's not true in the old funny gauge. Okay, so forgive me for my mistakes. This is indeed the thing that we will use in the future. Okay, so this is the standard definition of the comoving gauge. Okay, any other questions on that before we just accept that and move on? Okay, very good. So the other thing that came up yesterday was this question about the power spectra and how the dimensions work out. So I just want to go through that again and clarify it. So let's say I had some field 5x, and that field 5x was dimensionless. Then I can do a Fourier transform, and you can see that I pick up dimensions of k cubed for 5k, right? So I can define this correlator, this two-point function, phi k, phi star k, and that indeed would have dimensions of k to the sixth power, because I'm multiplying two of these Fourier coefficients. However, by the standard definition of the power spectrum, I have both this three-dimensional delta function and this thing that we called p phi of k. So the thing that I forgot yesterday, one should not forget, I will never forget again, and you will never forget also that the three-dimensional Dirac delta function contains dimensions of k cubed. So that means that this guy here has dimensions k cubed, right? Now I can define a dimensionless thing, a dimensionless power spectrum, which we call the script p phi, and that is related to the unscripted p phi by a factor of k cubed, and so this guy here would in fact be a dimensionless power spectrum. Yes. Okay, yeah, you're right. That's right. So it's k to the minus 3. So this thing is the dimensionless one. You guys are too good. Now I'm confused. Yep. Someone help me out. Don't let me struggle up here all by myself.
So doesn't the one on the left-hand side have dimensionless quantities too? Because if it was perfectly normalized and you're putting the same function in there, you'd get one.
Sorry? On the left-hand side where?
Well, on the left-hand side, the whole expectation value basically.
Yep.
If it was normalized in the same function, you could get one, right?
Normalized in the same function, what do you mean by that?
No, I'm not thinking of the right thing, don't mind.
Okay. So one of these guys is dimensionless for sure. Okay, in the interest of time to be continued, your assignment is to correct my mistakes because I cannot correct them myself. I apologize for that. Or I can show up tomorrow and then atone for my mistakes after atoning for my mistakes. Okay. So one of these guys is dimensionless. Please figure out for me which one. I don't know why this endlessly confuses me. I think I did the same thing last year. Anyway. Okay, so where were we from last time? So we were in the process of solving the Boltzmann equation, and we had expanded out df d tau into the various dependencies. F, we said, was made of a zeroth component. If we do a first order expansion, that's a function directly of tau and p, the magnitude of the momentum. And then we said this to first order was minus p times the derivative of f with respect to p times this photon distribution function, or the moments, not the moments, the this is delta t over t basically. And this thing was a function of tau, position, the magnitude of p, and the direction of p. So now I can expand out this total derivative. I had a partial derivative of f with respect to time. I had a partial derivative of f with respect to the position times dxi d tau. I had a partial derivative of f with respect to p times dp d tau. And I had a partial derivative of f with respect to p hat times the derivative of p hat with respect to tau. We chucked that because that was second order. And then we had various pieces in here. So for example, we found that to first order, this piece was p hat I. And then this one we got from the geodesic equation. And so so we had all the pieces, and we had yet to assemble all of the pieces. So so we can now assemble all of the pieces. So first we can assemble we can make the zeroth order piece. So the only things that contribute to the zeroth order piece are this term here. That's the derivative of f0 with respect to tau. And then we could also have this term here. This one is zero because f0 is not a function of position. So the only term I pick up is this guy here. So I have the derivative of f0 with respect to p times dp d tau. Okay, so zeroth order piece, we get the formal time derivative of f0 minus p. If you refer to your notes from last time for what we had, for the zeroth order piece of dp d tau, we just get that piece. Remember, that was the piece that was associated with the change in momentum for photons as they get stretched in an expanding universe. So we have that piece times dp f0 d tau. And we can rewrite this piece slightly. So we can rewrite the tau derivative of f0 as minus the tau derivative of the temperature times p over t times dp f0. So that's just applying the chain rule, basically, and realizing that f is a function of p over t, f0. So what was f0? That was just 1 over e to the p over t minus 1. Okay, so we can rewrite that piece. And now you'll notice a rather nice thing happened. So you can see that both this term and this term are proportional to minus p times the p derivative of f0. So I can pull that part out. So I get minus p times dp f0 times whatever's left over. So from this here, I just have the tau derivative of the temperature over the temperature. And from this piece here, I have the tau derivative of A over A. And that thing should equal 0. So now we know that for an arbitrary choice of P, this thing is not 0. So this thing in here should be 0. Okay. And what do we learn? So we learn that D tau t over t should be equal to negative d tau a over a. And of course, the solution to that is that t is proportional to 1 over a. And that's exactly what we'd expect. So as photons get stretched with the expansion of the universe, they lose energy. And so the temperature should basically go down by a corresponding factor as 1 over a. And I keep the same shape of my distribution function because the energy of each photon is redshifting by exactly the same amount. It's just all redshifting by the scale factor. Okay, so that's the zeroth order piece. The first order piece, we can plug in the stuff we had before, and in the interest of time, I will spare the algebra. But in a way very similar to what happened for the zeroth order piece, We can write the various derivatives of f as derivatives with respect to p. The derivatives of f0 as derivatives with respect to p. And what we will find is that we get a term that looks like the tau derivative of theta. That, of course, is just the first term up there, the first order piece of that, minus p hat I, that's the df dxi, dxi d tau term, times dxi theta. You can see how that would come pretty easily. I have the partial derivative of phi with respect to tau. That came from the first part of the geodesic equation, the one that had to do with the redshifting of photons as they travel through a time-varying potential well. And then finally, I have the piece from the geodesic equation that tells me about how photons lose energy as they travel into a potential well that varies with space, so for a difference in potentials. Okay, and so here's what we get for df d tau, just assembling these various pieces we had before. And at first order, I have to worry about this collisional term that we had in the Boltzmann equation. So this is not equal to zero, but it's equal to this collisional term. So we need to do that. In a perfect world, I could spend a lecture on Compton scattering, but we don't live in a perfect world, and I've already made enough mistakes in this course, so I will just quote the result and refer you to, for example, Dottelson's textbook, where he has a really nice discussion of this. So if we calculate this collisional term, really what we're talking about is photons scattering on electrons. So photons like to interact with charged particles, and the cross-section for electrons is larger than it is for protons, and so that's why electrons are the relevant things to consider here. So the cross-section, the total cross-section for scattering photons on electrons is just 8 pi times the fine structure constant squared over 3 times the mass of the electron squared. And of course, here is where we see that electrons are more important than protons, right? Because the mass of the proton is much bigger than the mass of the electron, so the cross-section would be much smaller. So electrons are the relevant charged particle that we want to interact our photons with. And why are there electrons around? The reason that there are electrons around is that the early universe is hot, and so for a very long time, it is effectively ionized. In fact, we can compute the mean free path of photons. So the mean free path is going to basically go like 1 over the cross-section times the number density of electrons. And as long as these can interact efficiently, that is, as long as L is much, much greater than H inverse, then this interaction between photons and electrons is efficient, and the photon bath can keep the electrons from finding their protons and making neutral hydrogen. Okay. So if you are taking the explorations in particle, you've probably seen this calculation done in a slightly more careful way. So basically you get freeze out of different species in an interaction when the interaction rate becomes small enough that they don't interact once per Hubble time. And this is just the same statement. So as long as the mean free path is big enough, or is small enough, excuse me, is small compared to the horizon size, then I can maintain equilibrium and I can keep these photons interacting with my electrons. So a careful treatment would reveal the following answer for this collision term. So again, I get something that's proportional to these derivatives of F0 with respect to the momentum. I get a number density of the electrons times a cross section, so basically 1 over the mean free path, times the scale factor. And then appearing in the inside is the zeroth moment of the photon distribution, and then a term that has to do with the velocity of the electrons. Okay, so theta zero, remember how theta is defined, it's proportional to this integral d mu over 2 times the Legendre polynomial PL of mu times theta itself. And if I want the zeroth moment, theta zero, then I have P zero, but this is just really a constant. So you can think of theta zero as the average anisotropy seen by someone at x and tau. Okay, so this is really just kind of the average temperature that I'd see if I smeared delta t over t over the whole sky of someone sitting at a given point. Okay, and here you can see we couple to the baryon velocity. And you can see in here is a p hat. So the only thing that where a p hat appears is through this coupling to the baryon velocity. Okay. So this is the collisional term. Just one more definition. So we often define the optical depth as the tau derivative. Okay, so the optical depth is this thing called tau tilde. So here again is an unfortunate notational sacrifice that one had to make. Oftentimes the optical depth is called tau, but I've used that letter and there just aren't enough letters, so we're going to call the optical depth tau tilde. If you look a lot of other places, they would call the optical depth tau, but I can't do that. Okay, so the optical depth is just defined as minus, the tau derivative of it is minus the number density of electrons times this cross section times the scale factor. So, what do we know about this time derivative of the optical depth? Well, when we're in equilibrium, then this combination here, n e times sigma t, is much, much bigger, much, much smaller than h. So n e sigma t is, did I get that right? No, that should be, that's wrong, right? So I want a really small mean free path if I want it to be in equilibrium. Okay, so in equilibrium, that thing is much, much smaller than H inverse. So N E times sigma T should be much, much bigger than H, right? Just flipping that around. And so that implies that A times N E times sigma. So what do we want? We want our length much, much smaller than H inverse, so no, it's right, yeah. Okay, so A times NE times sigma t is much, much bigger than AH. And what is that? That's just negative times the tau derivative of tau tilde. So this piece here is much, much bigger than AH. And remember, AH is the sort of scale of horizon crossing. And K K compared to AH tells me about the behavior of perturbations. So this term here, this coefficient of the collisional term, is really important compared to this dynamical scale, as long as I'm in equilibrium. Okay? And that's an important thing to know. Okay, so now we can just assemble and go to Fourier space. So when I do that, this equation here becomes the following. So I get a minus p df0 dp times the tau derivative of theta plus ik mu. Remember, mu is defined as p hat dotted into k hat theta. That, just to see where things come from, you see I have a p hat dotted into dx, and that dx turns into an ik. So that's where the mu came from. And then I want to express everything in terms of the magnitude of k, so that's k without a vector, plus the tau derivative of phi, plus ik mu times psi. And that thing, because the collisional term is also proportional to p times the p derivative of f, this is equal to the tau derivative of the optical depth, theta 0 minus theta plus mu times the irrotational part of VB. So remember also that we could write VBI as the I derivative of VB, as long as we assume that there's no vorticity, which we do. Okay, so all of that hard work was to go into basically deriving this equation here. And that's it. So this is the equation that governs the evolution of the photon distribution function. And there is an important limit that we can look at, which is known as tight coupling. And this has to do with the epoch when the photons and electrons scatter efficiently. And you can see that the photons and electrons scatter efficiently, of course, when the mean free path is really big, really small compared to the horizon size. And that happens when this term here is really big compared to AH. So if I look at this equation, the term on the right-hand side becomes really important, right? So this term has got a huge coefficient in front of it, and I need to make the momenta really big in order to compete with that. Or I have to make these time derivatives of phi really big in order to compete with that. So as long as I'm looking at scales k, which are sort of sandwiched in between, on the one hand, they should be smaller than this tau derivative of, bigger than this, smaller than this tau derivative of tau tilde. Yeah, let's just look at k smaller than that. Then I can take that equation, and it becomes the tau derivative of theta. I can neglect this guy here. I can neglect this guy here. And as you're working through your homework, you'll note that this thing can often be neglected, like in a matter-dominated universe on really small k's, that thing can be neglected. So we'll just forget about everything on the left-hand side except for this piece here. So I've got the tau derivative of tau tilde, theta 0 minus theta. And we'll also neglect this baryonic velocity component and just think what would happen based on this equation here. So so you can see that I have negative theta on the right-hand side. So I have a coefficient times negative theta. And that implies that here, theta is driven towards theta 0. So if I evolve this equation, I've got this huge coefficient times negative theta, okay? And that's just going to drive me to theta 0 to make this 0 on the right-hand side. Yeah, so this one pairs with this one, so that, yeah, just it multiplies the whole thing. Yeah, so you just get rid of this, and then you can see that this part is equal to that part. Yep. Okay, so a consequence of this equation, when this term is way more important than the terms proportional to k, is that theta is driven to theta 0. And you can think about the physical interpretation of that as being basically the temperature anisotropy seen by electrons are small. It's basically just I see some cloud, I see some average temperature. And there's a picture that we can draw that goes along with that. So if I have a spatial slice, x versus y, and there's some variation of the temperature. So these shaded regions would be, say, hot, and these unshaded regions would be cold. I can put an electron here. And for these wavelengths that are much longer than the mean free path of photons, L, I basically see this is the place that the electrons came from me last, right? So that you could think of as the sort of surface of last scattering. So most of the photons I receive come from this region here. And it's a relatively uniform temperature. If I make that circle arbitrarily small, then it becomes more and more uniform. Okay, so the temperature anisotropy seen by this electron is really boring. It's just the same everywhere. And that holds independent of where I choose to stick my electron. Okay, so the variation in temperature seen by this electron gets arbitrarily small as L gets arbitrarily small compared to H, compared to K, excuse me. So that's the story that goes with this picture. This equation is just encoding that fact that temperature anisotropy seen by electrons are small. And if I had a variation that, you know, was a much larger value of k, so a much smaller wavelength, now on this picture, you can see that the electron can see an appreciable temperature variation, but something else is going on too, which is that photons from this hot place can go into this cold place and try and equilibrate the temperature. Okay, so as long as the mean free distance traveled by photons is if the mean free distance traveled by photons, which you can think of as more or less like the number of scatters times the square root of the mean free path, because the square root of the mean free path is sort of the distance that's taken on each leg of a random walk. So if these photons are random walking around, so on distances that are, so for k inverse that are less than these distances of the random walk, then the fact that the hot regions can communicate with the cold regions efficiently basically washes out any variations in the temperature. So for k inverse less than the distance of the random walk, the temperature anisotropies are washed out. And we'll see that in a few minutes, why that's important. Yeah, you're probably right. That's right. Yeah, cheers. Okay, so what do we learn here? We learn here that that in this tightly coupled era, the large L moments of the photon distribution function are suppressed. So theta goes to theta zero. Everything looks like an average. To me, if I'm an electron, I basically see the same temperature everywhere. So we can get equations for the moments of theta. By just multiplying by Legendre polynomials, PL mu, and integrating. So just like spherical harmonics or any other special function, orthogonal group of complete group of special functions, if I multiply this entire equation by PL mu and I integrate, I will just pick out the Lth component of the distribution function. So I will just retain the piece that corresponds to L. So performing that exercise, which you should definitely perform, we get that the tau derivative of theta 0, k times theta 1, is equal to negative d tau phi. So you can kind of see how that happened here. So when I multiply here, I get theta 0. I pick that out directly. When I multiply by PL here, I have a power of mu. And so that takes me to L plus 1. So mu times P0 would be proportional to P1. So that's where this term gets picked out. Here, I picked that out because I'm basically just averaging. Okay. Here, I get 0 because I don't have an expansion of psi. I just have an expansion of theta. And then on the right-hand side, again, I get 0. How does that go? Because I get theta 0 here, but then I pick out the theta 0 component of that guy, and those cancel. Right? So that's why I get nothing on the right-hand side. OK, so one can do that exercise, and you can get the zeroth moment. We can perform the same exercise, multiply by the L equals 1 Legendre polynomial, and we get the following equation, k over 3, theta 0, plus 2k over 3, theta 2, and that equals k over 3 psi, plus now I get a contribution from that collisional term, which picks out the theta 1 component. And then because I have a mu multiplying the baryon velocity, I pick that out as well because I'm multiplying by p1. Okay, so this is what we get for the theta 1 component of the distribution function. And we could keep going and we could get a tower of, now I could get another one for theta 2 and so on and so forth. Okay, so we get this tower of equations for these moments of the distribution function. But for all intents and purposes, during this tightly coupled era, I only really care about these two. And the physical reason is that electrons just see a very uniform temperature distribution. So for all intents and purposes, during this tightly coupled era, I only need to keep track of these two pieces. And furthermore, I can get rid of this, this term in the equation that's proportional to theta 2. Okay, and that's it. So this tower of equations, this it's called the Boltzmann hierarchy. Is all that I need to solve for the photon distribution function. Yes.
So
that's right. So by tightly coupled, I mean that the photons and the electrons are undergoing constant interaction, and so in that sense, they're tightly coupled. Okay. So. A few things happen. So the universe expands and it cools, and you can see what happens here. So the mean free path is 1 over sigma t times the number density. And the number density is proportional to 1 over 8 cubed, because just from the increase in the volume, right? So if 1 over 8 cubed can catch up with H inverse, then eventually this thing will go out of equilibrium, and that indeed does happen in a radiation-dominated universe, that will end up going out of equilibrium. Then at that time, once the electrons, so let's say this here, so electrons and protons, let's draw a timeline. Maybe that's the best way to do this. So if I have a timeline, at this time, electrons and photons scatter efficiently. That means so-called tight coupling. There's a time here when the mean free path becomes of order H inverse. And at that time, a few things happen, a few interesting things happen. So of course, out here, electrons and photons don't scatter if I go to late enough times. And so for that reason, this time here is sometimes referred to as last scattering, because photons cease to interact with the electrons, and so once after that time, the photons that I received today from the CMB are basically pristine. They haven't scattered since this time, hence the name last scattering. Another thing that happens, of course, is the electrons and the photons are now decoupled, so they don't interact very much anymore. And so this time here is often also called decoupling. And the other interesting thing that happens is once I don't have these annoying photons in the way, you know, it's like being the third wheel on a date or something. Once the annoying guy goes away, then finally, you know, things can proceed. And so then you get you get recombination. So now with the photons out of the way, the electrons and the protons can find each other and live happily ever after as neutral hydrogen. So this time is also often called recombination. So and this all has to do with this scattering of electrons off of the photons. Okay. So So that's kind of a big picture of what's going on. Did that answer your question? Maybe, okay. Ask again then, if there's a part you didn't understand. Okay. Okay, so all of this is going on. And with respect to these moments, you know, if I'm living during this time of tight coupling, then my surface of last scattering, the place that the photons came, is actually really close to me. And that's in a sense why I don't see any variation in the temperature. It's like living in a cloud, to give you another analogy, right? So if it's a really cloudy day, but the clouds are really high, and I can see them, they're distinct, and there's all this sky between me, and it's very clear that it's a really cloudy sky, and I can see all the differences. But if it's a really foggy day, and I'm living inside the cloud, then I can't really see that structure, right? And so that's kind of what it's like. If I'm living during the time of tight coupling, it's a really foggy day, I can't really see all the structure around me. If I'm living now, after recombination, decoupling, last scattering, then I can see all these nice clouds on the background of a blue sky, and I can see all that structure. So that's the analogy you should have in your head. Okay, so now I can take this Boltzmann hierarchy and I can combine it with the equations for dark matter and gravity and baryons. So I could combine with equations for dark matter, baryons, and gravity. And in doing so, I will have a complete set of equations. I will have everything I need to solve cosmological perturbation theory in the presence of photons, dark matter, and baryons. So for completeness, let's write out these equations. So I have the equations for dark matter, which is that guy. I have an equation for the velocities of dark matter, which looks something like that. I have an equation for the density contrast of baryons, which was that. I have an equation for the velocity distribution of baryons, but I need an addition, because you can see that the photons, they couple to the velocity of the baryons. Okay. So again, I refer you to Dottleson for a more complete treatment, but the term that you get here, again, has to do with the scattering cross-section, how efficient the interactions are, divided by this thing R. So R is just defined as 3 times the background baryon density over 4 times the background photon density. So this again is something that tells me a little bit, you know, what's the mixture, how dilute are the photons compared to the baryons. So that's why it's a relevant term here. And then this multiplies VB times 3i times the first moment. So again, you can see there that the coupling between the baryon velocity and the photon distribution function has to do with that first moment. So that's why it also shows up in this equation. And then we have gravity. So for gravity, we had k squared phi plus 3 times the tau derivative of A over A times d tau phi minus d tau A over A times psi. And that we had the contribution from the dark matter. We have the contribution from the baryons. And then, again, we can evaluate the energy momentum tensor for photons using the distribution function. And it turns out that the first order correction would have to do with theta zero, which kind of makes sense, right? This is basically saying I boost the radiation energy density by a factor that tells me how much hotter it is, right, at a given location. So that's why it's proportional to theta zero. You get the four by being a little bit more careful. And then finally, we have the other Einstein equation, which told me how phi and psi are coupled. And this is zero, except for when I consider this this second moment. Okay, so the quadrupole of the photon distribution can source differences between these gravitational potentials. And that's it. So so if I combine that Boltzmann hierarchy with this set of equations, then I can send you off and you can calculate anything you would ever want to know about cosmological perturbation theory in the presence of photons, dark matter, baryons, and gravity. So in a sense, that is a, I don't know, that's the punchline of this first part of the course, was some understanding of the physics that goes into these equations. We could have started here and then just derived the consequences. But more or less, you know, now you know how to derive this set of governing equations. These are the governing equations for cosmological perturbation theory. Okay, so in the last few minutes, I will just tell you a few things about this set of equations. And then in your tutorial today, you'll explore some of these things in a bit more detail. And in the homework, you will explore some of these things in a bit more detail. But more or less, I just wanted to get you to this set of governing equations in the first part of the course. And then now you're equipped to explore the consequences. Okay, so it turns out that we can manipulate that set of equations and get an equation for theta zero only, for just that zeroth component of the photon distribution function. So you can check Donaldson for the algebra, but here's what you'll get. So remember, R was this ratio of 3 rho baryon bar over 4 rho radiation bar. And the sound speed is defined as 1 over 3 times 1 plus r. Okay, the reason we call it a sound speed is because it's a thing that multiplies the gradient. So in analogy with the equations we had written down before, this has to do with the pressure. On the right-hand side, we've got k squared over 3 times 1 over 1 plus r times phi minus psi. So we can look at k goes to 0. This gives us a set of initial conditions. If we looked at that set of equations on the right-hand side and took k to 0, one would find that In this limit, things are frozen, as we had said before, so the time evolution stops, and we can relate theta and phi, and we can relate the baryon density also to phi. Phi zero. If we looked at the velocity equations, so k would go to zero, you could see that the velocity for dark matter would just end up decaying. The velocity for the baryons would also end up decaying. That's a little bit more difficult to see. Here I'd ignore this term. And now this thing is super huge because I'm in this early radiation-dominated era. Things are very tightly coupled, and the baryonic velocity would be directly related to theta 1. But then if I look at the equation for theta 1, I'd see that that thing decays. So this would be one piece. The velocities for the cold dark matter and the baryons would be 0, and theta 1 would also be very small, so close to 0. So that's a consistent set of initial conditions that we'd get. And now we can ask what happens at slightly larger k. So still k slightly larger, but still early times. So tightly coupled. And what we'd see at this slightly larger times, but when things are still more or less tightly coupled, is that this equation looks an awful lot like an oscillator equation with the forcing term. So I have some dt squared plus k squared times the sound speed squared. There's this damping piece that adds something. But you can see that this takes the form of an oscillatory solution. And so a valid solution during this time is that theta 0 plus phi goes like theta at some initial time plus phi at that initial time times cosine of k times this thing here, which is called the sound horizon. So this is defined as the integral from 0 to tau, d tau prime. Integrate the, basically I take the sound speed and I integrate it over time. And that's effectively how far sound can propagate from the beginning of the universe until some fiducial time. So that's why we call it the sound horizon. Okay, plus some term that tells me about the forcing. Okay, so I have to include that, but this is going to be one solution. If I set the right hand side to zero, that would actually be the solution, just this cosine. Okay, so here is where we see how we get these acoustic features in the photon distribution. So for k equals n times pi over the sound horizon, then the cosine is at a maximum. And so the value of this combination is at a maximum at that point. And then, of course, when I have an integer or a half integer fraction, then that thing is going to be at a minimum. So these are the famous baryon acoustic oscillations. So at really early times, everything's frozen. At slightly later times, but still during tight coupling, I have this oscillation. And then, if you like, at really late times, when I'm talking about really small scales, I have this damping that I referred to up there. And so that'll be the last thing I have to say. Those are the three main features of this famous plot. So if we plot this angular power spectrum times this funny factor here, I get a plateau. This is when things are frozen. I get these acoustic peaks. These are the baryon acoustic oscillations associated with these maxima of the photon distribution function. And then I get this damping. And that has to do with rapid scattering, washing out things that happen on really small scales. Okay, so on this plot, L goes to zero. These are large scales, and these are small scales. Okay, so that's the physics that goes into this. And of course, we get this by doing this integral that we had written down before with this kernel. So we get the CL by taking all the physics associated with this set of equations and convolving it with some set of initial conditions. But just the physics involved, we didn't get to do that, unfortunately, but the physics involved, you've seen it all. Okay, so this has to do with the stuff that's frozen. The peaks have to do with this oscillatory feature of the baryons, and this damping has to do with the fact that really early on, photons and electrons interact efficiently, but photons can travel far enough to sort of wash out the temperature if I look at small enough scales. Okay, so I'm out of time. I apologize for that. Tomorrow we will start, Paul McFadden will take over and he's gonna start telling you about inflation. So I've told you about all the physics that happens at late times. So that's been part one. I've given you a little bit of a flavor what goes into there, and we're gonna start with part two, which is just where did these initial conditions actually come from? Okay. And then part three, Dan will take over and he'll tell you why that's a crazy picture and there are all these dramatic consequences of inflation, like we're all gonna meet again in this room in 10 to the 100 years and have the same class, except for you're going to be teaching and I'm going to be in the audience. So, something weird like that. Okay, so thanks very much, and I'll be hanging out, so I'll see you tomorrow. But that's it for my lectures. Thanks.